All right, well, my watch says 6:17, and since I'll be showing some movie clips, I feel like there's a lot to get in, and I want to make sure everybody has a chance to ask any questions they have and so forth. So I think I'll go ahead and begin, and just welcome, and thanks for coming out. My name is Mike Van Quickenborn, and what I'm going to be doing today here is just try to explain why I try to look for philosophy in films. I teach philosophy at Everett Community College, which is half an hour north of Seattle if you're not from Washington State. And there I designed a course called Philosophy in the Cinema back in 2000, I guess. And I've been teaching that there ever since. In 2008, I beat another film festival by just a few months, but I put on the world's first philosophical film festival called Philosophy in the Dark. Did that a couple of years there as well. So I'm really enjoy this kind of material and presenting philosophy through the medium of film. And that's what I'm going to be doing tonight. And then we have different film clips and issues come up tomorrow. I think tomorrow's at 4 o'clock. Right here again. And then something else on Wednesday and Thursday as well. And then on Friday of this week, I'll be doing what's called a Socrates Cafe. Which no film's involved there, but it's just an informal way to generate philosophical discussions that's been pioneered by a person by the name of Christopher Phillips. And anyway, I'll be doing that on Friday at 4 o'clock, I think. At any rate, it's on the kiosk, of course. excuse me. I also wanted to mention a couple other things. Tomorrow's theme, well, this won't really work very well, but tomorrow's theme is on humor and philosophy, and it's at 4 o'clock, I believe, and at the same time, we have the LOGA presentations, so there can be a lot of laughter between this room and the next one, so anyway, you'll have to choose what kind of laughter you want, but anyway, that's tomorrow, and then also tomorrow night at, it's 8:30, I'm going to present a film in its entirety called The Song of Sparrows, and then I'll, since it'll be from 8:30 till about 10, it's about an hour and a half, won't have too much of a chance to talk about it, but then on Thursday's session, I should have a little bit of time to talk about that some more. The Song of Sparrows is an Iranian film from 2008, I just say that I think it ties in. It is heavily influenced by Islam, of course, but it ties in, I think, very nicely to this summer's theme and what's going on in the village right now, but that's just the teaser to get you to show up on Tuesday, tomorrow night at 8:30. It's an excellent film, though. I think you'll enjoy it regardless of your interest. One other thing is, if you have any further interest in this topic of film and philosophy, I have a bibliography and a filmography that I put together with suggestions for films and books on philosophy in the cinema. What was your name again?
Ian,
right. Ian and I are working on making photocopies of that. Got one third of the way there, but it's a kind of a slower copy machine, so by tomorrow I should have copies. Or you can just give me your email address, and we can avoid paper altogether, and I can email you a copy if you'd like. I can write that down after tonight's session or anytime this week. I guess I should mention that if you are interested in this topic further, you can go to my website. Of course, everybody has a website, and mine is philosophyinthecinema.com. It's one word, very, very long word, right? philosophyinthecinema.com, and there you'll be inundated with advertisements. No. There's no ads there, and I'm not trying to sell anything. It's just the website that I've registered that I use with my class, Philosophy in the Cinema, which I'll actually be teaching in Everett here in a couple of weeks when our academic year starts. We're on the quarter system, so we don't start till September 23rd or so. One other thing, I don't see any people that I have to check your ID or anything like that, but the film clips are of a PG nature, except for tomorrow night, or it'll be tomorrow afternoon, I guess. A couple bad words that you'll have to listen carefully for. At any rate, I just want to get through a few points here, and then I'll talk about why I want to show you a clip from The Matrix, and then we'll also have a couple of clips from a film called Waking Life. I'm always interested in introducing people to new films, but this film, The Matrix, which I almost always show in this class, is one that usually people have seen. And so I ask with regard to The Matrix, this film, how many of you have not seen The Matrix? Okay. All right, so a good number of you. The number is going up as the years go by, which is, you know, not surprising. And then the other film that I'll show a couple clips from tonight is called Waking Life. It's an animated film. It's kind of an unusual animation style. And with regard to that film, because I don't think that many people have seen it, I say, how many of you have seen Waking Life? And so just one. That's, yeah, okay. Good. So a lot of you get introduced to some new films. Have any of you, by the way, seen The Song of Sparrows, the Iranian film?
We saw. What can you just give a little over? We saw an Iranian film. It was very good. But it was about voting.
This was not about voting.
Okay.
Yeah, not about voting. So I think I saw one, maybe two heads nod on The Song of Sparrows. So anyway, I encourage you to come out for that tomorrow night. All right, well, why would somebody look for philosophy in the cinema? Well, I've been teaching philosophy since 1992, and for the first 6 years or so, I really struggled, as a lot of philosophers do, or people who are trying to teach philosophy at any rate, to get first-year college students to care about material that's sometimes quite abstract or foreign to them. And then in 1998, The Matrix was released, and sort of it just kind of blew my mind open for this possibility. And so I want to share some of that tonight. And I wanted to try and get you to experience kind of what I've experienced by sharing with you sort of a traditional philosophical text, and I'll read an excerpt from Plato's Republic, and then I'm going to show you a clip from The Matrix, and you can compare the two and see if they're comparable, or I can explain why I think it's useful to use The Matrix to explain this idea. The passage from Plato's Plato's Republic, that's what I call it. The Republic that I want to read is the Allegory of the Cave, which is a fairly well-known story there. But I wanted to read it to you here in its... want to read it to you in the original text. And in Plato's dialogues, he's written, of course, a number of dialogues, so you have different characters speaking. In the Republic, you have Socrates, right, another famous Greek philosopher. That person as a character narrating, coming up with the allegory of the cave, and he's speaking to another character by the name of Glaucon. And so I'll just say that just to give you a little bit of an idea as to what's going on here. But I'm going to read now from The Republic, Book 7, just a couple pages, and you'll get a sense as to, you know, how philosophy often works, I guess, in undergraduate philosophy class, what the kinds of texts that students read. "And now," I said, "let me show in a figure how far our nature is enlightened or unenlightened. Behold, human beings living in an underground den, which has a mouth open towards the light and reaching all along the den, here they have been from their childhood, and have their legs and necks chained so that they cannot move, and can only see before them, being prevented by the chains from turning round their heads. Above and behind them is a fire is blazing at a distance. And between the fire and the prisoners, there is a raised way. And you will see, if you look, a low wall built along the way, like the screen which marionette players have in front of them, over which they show the puppets." And Glaucon says, "I see." "And do you see," I said, "men passing along the wall, carrying all sorts of vessels, and statues and figures of animals made of wood and stone and various materials which appear over the wall. Some of them are talking, others silent. You have shown me a strange image, and they are strange prisoners," says Glaucon. "Like ourselves," I replied, "and they see only their own shadows, or the shadows of one another, which the fire throws on the opposite wall of the cave." "True," he said, that is, Glaucon said. "How could they see anything but the shadows if they were never allowed to move their heads? And of the objects which are being carried in like manner, they would only see the shadows?" "Yes," he said. "And if they were able to converse with one another, would they not suppose that they were naming what was actually before them?" "Very true." "And suppose further that the prison had an echo which came from the other side, would they not be sure to fancy when one of the passers-by spoke that the voice which they heard came from the passing shadow?" "No question," he replied. "To them," I said, "the truth would be literally nothing but the shadows of the images." "That is certain," says Glaucon. "And now look again and see what will naturally follow if the prisoners are released and disabused of their error. At first, when any of them is liberated and compelled suddenly to stand up and turn his neck round and walk and look toward the light, he will suffer sharp pains The glare will distress him, and he will be unable to see the realities of which, in his former state, he had seen the shadows, and then conceive someone saying to him that what he saw before was an illusion, but that now, when he is approaching nearer to being, and his eye is turned toward more real existence, he has a clearer vision. What will be his reply? And you may further imagine that his instructor is pointing to the objects as they pass and requiring him to name them. Will he not be perplexed? Will he not fancy that the shadows which he formerly saw are truer than the objects which are now shown to him? Glaucon says, far truer. And if he is compelled to look straight at the light, will he not have a pain in his eyes which will make him turn away to take refuge in the objects of vision which he can see, and which he will conceive to be in reality clearer than the things which are now being shown to him? True, he said. And suppose once more that he is reluctantly dragged up a steep and rugged ascent and held fast until he is forced into the presence of the sun himself. Is he not likely to be pained and irritated? When he approaches the light, his eyes will be dazzled, and he will not be able to see anything at all of what are now called realities? Not all in a moment, he said. And then finally, Socrates says, he will require to grow accustomed to the sight of the upper world. It goes on from there, but I think that's enough to give us a sense of the allegory of the cave. So it's a powerful image, certainly one of the most famous ones from Greek literature. But I do think it's a little bit strange here, at least, right? Or at least raises some questions. It's a little bit implausible, not that the Matrix is entirely plausible, but it is a little bit implausible. I mean, why would anybody imprison people in a cave like this and make them look at shadows on a wall? That's not answered in the text. Why would the prisoners really think shadows are reality? Right? I can imagine, you know, the way I try and explain to my students is that these people are chained, right? And even their heads are sort of really paralyzed in a sense. So they can't turn and look to their neighbor and say, what is this stuff, right? But even if my head is sort of held fast, I can see the nose, you know, my nose at the end of my face there. Maybe I have a big nose, but somebody would have a big nose. And so, you know, what would they really believe, that all reality is just shadow rather than, you know, something different? So it seems a little bit perhaps fantastic or hard to believe. And I think what the Matrix can do is maybe make it a little bit more realistic, even though, of course, this is science fiction. So what I'm going to do here in just a moment is show you a six-minute passage from The Matrix. I'll give you a little context, because I know many of you have not seen the film. I do recommend it, even though it does have Keanu Reeves in it. But anyway, in the film, our young protagonist, Neo, who is played by Keanu Reeves, is a computer hacker, and he's an office worker, and he has long suspected that a vast conspiracy is at work in the world. He is contacted by Trinity, who is played by Carrie Moss, and she works for the infamous computer hacker known as Morpheus. Neo agrees to meet Morpheus, and you're about to see what follows that meeting. And then after you see this, we can talk about that.
This is your last chance. After this, there's no turning back. You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you wanted. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more. Trace program. It's designed to disrupt your input output carrier signal so we can pinpoint your location. What does that mean?
It means buckle your seatbelt, Dorothy, because Kansas is going bye-bye.
So sure it was real.
What if you were unable to wake from that dream? How would you know the difference between the dream world and the real world?
This can't be what? Be real?
It's going into reputation.
Hey, Bob, it's a little nothing. Location, target, almost there.
He's going into arrest.
Lock, I got him. Now, tank, now.
Plato, and you've got the Matrix. My hope is that when, you know, students might, I want my students to read these classic texts like the Allegory of the Cave, but again, I worry that they're not really going to feel Plato's concern about the nature of reality. And when they see a movie like this, or especially a scene like this, I'm hoping that makes it more real to them. I don't know if you have any questions or thoughts about that clip, or, you know, comparing it with Plato's classic text, if you think one works better than the other, or they're, you know, I don't know.
Well, it's a little hard to distinguish whether he was in the real world at the end or the beginning, or, you know, what.
Okay.
So, because of the Hollywood rendition of this, so I'm trying to sort that all out, and I'm having a little difficulty doing it.
Right, and yeah, and I, again, obviously there's a lot more in the movie that I'm not giving you here.
Right.
And there's before this, before he meets Morpheus, you know, there's a long sequence where he's doing his day-to-day office work.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. And then after this scene, he's on this dirty sort of spaceship, essentially, with these other people. And, you know, it's a very different kind of world. So it might make that point a little bit easier to, or the distinction there easier to pick
sure.
up on.
I think it does. Just having the clip doesn't give you enough context to really see that, feel that. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So is the a world supposed to be what your reality is? People in the cave, their reality was the shadows.
Right, and so Plato is definitely suggesting there that everything we perceive around us, that what our senses pick up on, is essentially an illusion. Or not fully real, it's just a shadow of the true reality, which for Plato was what he called the world of forms, which is a world that's essentially accessible only through our intellect. So Plato definitely wouldn't think that, you know, your reality is your reality and my reality is my reality. He'd totally reject that vision.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also something that happens throughout this film. These people that just now plucked Neo out of the juice there. They are definitely, we might say, hell-bent on making sure that people understand what reality is. And what's really going on is that, again, in the allegory of the cave, there's no explanation as to why are these people in prison? You know, who did this to them? Why would they want to do that to them? In the film, it's made clear that what happened is human beings designed artificial intelligence, and they wanted an endless source of power, and for some fairly implausible reasons, it turns out that human beings will provide the best source of power for their computers to keep running. And so they basically grow human beings in like a vat, like you saw, to provide them with power. And then they sort of channel this artificial reality into their minds using all those cables that you saw. So there's at least a little bit of a backstory as to why these people are under these illusions. The people who just, quote-unquote, rescued Neo are trying to defeat those computers. And if they have to kill lots and lots of people to do it, I mean, so be it. So they're definitely not, you know, of the mindset that, you know, your reality is your reality and my reality is my reality.
So those people are really the good people in the movie?
They are supposed to be. I have a lot of qualms, ethically speaking, about the film. Not philosophically speaking, in terms of the what you might call the metaphysics there, what's reality. But ethically speaking, yeah, they kill lots of people to sort of achieve their ends. And why? Well, it's because they're fighting for reality and for people to know what reality is. And for them, that justifies just about anything.
The prisoners are put into reality, but they can't tolerate it because it's just too shocking for them.
Right.
And then does Plato's writing go on and then show them adjusting to reality?
No, it's not that pretty. Yeah, it's another page and a half there before you get to somebody has learned, oh, these shadows, this is just all an illusion, and they want to, of course, go back and tell their fellow prisoners that this is wrong, and of course what they do is kill them, right? So that person who has seen reality, because they think, oh, you're crazy, stop trying to mess with our understandings of reality. Uh-huh. So yeah, it doesn't come to a happy end there. Yes?
Are you familiar with the play? I think it's called Molly Sweeney, about a blind woman, and she has an operation. She was, like, pretty happy being blind. She can go swimming and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And her husband gets like the greatest ophthalmologist in the world to, you know,
restore her
blindness.
Vision.
And yeah, she goes mad. I mean, she doesn't.
Oh.
Unhappy ending.
Okay. Right. Yeah, I didn't know that. Thank you. It's called Molly Sweeney.
I think so.
Okay. Yeah, and that's kind of an interesting thing about this film is these people are out rescuing, quote-unquote, all of these people in the vats, right? And in those vats, they're having sort of a sense of reality that's basically akin to what life was supposed to be like in North America in the late last part of the 20th century. And then they rescue them, right? And they wake up. And they wake up in this horrible sort of situation. Oh, by the way, we're at war with machines that, you know, are vastly superior to us. We don't have any food. You have to eat this sludge that, you know, always tastes the same because they're all underground. They live underground. They can't see the sun. It's likely that they're going to be wiped out, right? And so they're supposed to be thankful that they've been rescued and told, this is, now you've woken up and this is really reality. Yeah.
So I did not see The Matrix. Can I just get some basics?
Absolutely,
like,
yeah.
So the guy who took the red pill is the same guy who ended up bald with all the cables?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the blue pill. The red
pill.
Right. Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The piece about, in the context of the Platonic,
right,
ideal kind of thing.
Right.
How does that, from your perspective, trace through in The Matrix? You know, the idea that the things that we see, the things that we sense, have an actual reality elsewhere, and all we're seeing and acknowledging and are comfortable with are the pale imitations.
Right, so as far as the film suggests, everything you and I are perceiving right now is virtual reality, we might say, that's being fed to us by a computer program, and we just exist in these vats. And so we are all prisoners, again, like in the allegory, all human beings are prisoners and subject to just nonstop illusion, endless shadows. And so Plato wants people to wake up to reality, because it's real and the shadows aren't, right? And think of those poor saps that are only experiencing shadows as, and thinking that's reality. And basically, more or less for the same reason, these people, Morpheus and company that go about rescuing people, quote-unquote, they have sort of the same motivation, really. It's not as if the artificial intelligence wants to get rid of the human beings. They want to keep them around. And in fact, they said that initially, this is part of the movie, I hope you all go out and see it now, but they said that initially they programmed human beings to live in sort of a utopia as a virtual reality, but that people couldn't accept it. It was too unrealistic. And so they said, they lost whole crops, I think, something like this, you know, people, because they couldn't accept that. So they had to program in struggles and pain and all this other stuff that we, you know, experience ourselves. And so it's not as if the artificial intelligence is necessarily wanting to destroy human beings. They just don't want them to be aware of reality. These people feel very strongly that they ought to know what reality is. Everyone ought to. And so they're going to do what they can to defeat the artificial intelligence.
But in Plato, the illusion is ours. It seems to me like we are this even though we're sentient beings, we are the critters that are creating or acknowledging or living within the illusions. Rather than the reality.
Right.
And Morpheus really means is sleep. So you know, I always was kind of curious about that and whether or not, you know, the idea of of reality being in a different state of consciousness, you know, which is sort of the implication of the name.
Well, maybe in the name, but certainly in the films, there's never given that suggestion that this reality that Neo wakes up into is itself an illusion. I mean, we're never given that suggestion. In fact, after this movie came out, they had two others after that, right?
Yeah.
But I was telling my students that the sequel, before I knew anything about it, the sequel would be The Matrix 2, The Dream Within the Dream, right? And then they'd all wake up again, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how could we know that they wouldn't be able to do that, right? We wouldn't be able to know that. But that's never broached in the three films. In Plato's allegory, though, of course, people are prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't put themselves in that situation. And so...
we don't know how they got in that situation. They could have volunteered these things. I mean, we don't
Well, know. I don't know. The story becomes, I think, a little bit more implausible then because, of course, they would have been outside and then going... Or they would have seen something other than shadows, right?
So they're born into that situation.
Seems like you have to read the allegory that way for it to be plausible that you would only think the shadows of reality, at least as far as I read it. But, yes?
Yeah, but the allegory does seem to imply that there's some connection between between reality and the illusion of reality, the shadows, that, you know, the shadows of the real object, or the
right.
Matrix,
mm-hmm.
is this kind of totally constructed spectacle. So I've seen it as it used to illustrate society's spectacle, that kind of notion. But it does create this binary, true consciousness, false consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think you have to really buy into that truth versus falsity to really, so to speak, root for the protagonists in the film, the people like Morpheus and so on, and Neo eventually, who are going to go out and do all this stuff to defeat the artificial intelligence. And I think it kind of sucks you into that. I guess it'll be Wednesday. I'm going to talk more about truth, philosophically speaking, and then look at some other films that'll deal with that. So if you're interested in that particular aspect, try coming on Wednesday. I forget what time it is, but at any rate, was there another hand or something I thought I saw? Yes.
Well, yeah. I mean, I may have read the Plato thing many, many years ago, but just for this, I mean, I guess my non-expert take on it is just that. You know, he's not saying literally this happened. I took it to be
Plato.
Right.
Okay.
He's saying this is a. You know, I mean, I took it to be this is a metaphor for okay, how many things in our lives are we not seeing the reality? We're just, you know, seeing.
Right.
We don't know how expanded our consciousness can get.
Yes, except I mean, as it's clear, and not just from what we read, but he thinks that all perception. Is an illusion.
Okay.
And so we should strive to be essentially philosophers. Everybody should strive to be a philosopher. Only use the intellect to engage the world because that's the ultimate reality is found through the intellect and not through perception.
Okay.
So, yeah. I would also want to touch on here, and I'm sorry, just trying to keep an eye on the clock here, but I also want to address tonight, you know, why should people study philosophy in the first place? Obviously, it gives people headaches, you know, and so forth. I do want to say that without the ability to talk about fundamentally important questions, I think we're often left to violence and manipulation. And I wanted to motivate that thought by watching an excerpt from a 2001 film by Richard Linklater called Waking Life, which sounds like maybe just one of you has seen, a couple of you. By the way, this is sort of a weird tangent, but if you remember Jared Loughner, the person who had the shot up the people in Tucson, this was one of his favorite films. He was obsessed with this, but I don't see the connection. At any rate, maybe I'm not reading it like I should be. And I do think that The Matrix is often described as one of the most philosophical films ever made. I think the Waking Life here would be certainly a close runner-up, if not, you know, candidate for the most philosophical film ever made. It's kind of like, I would say, a philosophical fruitcake, if we could use that metaphor, the allegory of the fruitcake, we might say. It's got a lot of, it's very dense and varied. It touches on a lot of different philosophical questions. There's a very loose plot. There's a very loose plot centered around the character, an unnamed character, played by Wiley Wiggins, and he seems to be trapped in a dream, and he's trying to wake up, and he's never sure if he's able to wake up throughout the entire film. During his dream, he encounters a host of characters, mostly unnamed thinkers in a variety of fields, including philosophy. And in the following clip I'm going to show here first, Wiggins' character is talking to another unnamed character, played by the actor J.C. Shakespeare. And let me see, it's chapter 4. And I usually start off my philosophy in the cinema class with this film because it's fairly strange, and I'd like to scare off any students that just are not going to be able to handle strangers. So in the end, people actually end up really liking it, but
considerable losses and catastrophes. These wars, famines, floods, and quakes meet well-defined needs. Man wants chaos. In fact, he's gotta have it. Depression, strife, riots, murder, all this dread.
We're irresistibly drawn to that almost orgiastic state created out of death and destruction. It's in all of us. We revel in it.
Sure, the media tries to put a sad face on these things, painting them up as great human tragedies. But we all know the function of the media has never been to eliminate the evils of the world. No. Their job is to persuade us to accept those evils and get used to living with them. The powers that be want us to be passive observers. They get a match? And they haven't given us any other options outside the occasional purely symbolic participatory act of voting. You want the puppet on the right or the puppet on the left? I feel that the time has come to project my own inadequacies and dissatisfactions into the socio-political and scientific schemes. Let my own lack of a voice be heard.
See that coming, right? So why do I think philosophy is important? Well, I think if people don't feel like they have the tools or the ability to discuss important or fundamental questions, it leads to violence, self-violence. And I think philosophy, if they have the ability to talk about these deep questions, will give people tools to avoid things like this. I would define philosophy as a non-empirical subject that attempts to answer the fundamental questions that arise in all areas of life. And so I don't think anybody should have to turn to that. And if they have an ability to talk about this stuff, they hopefully wouldn't have to do that. You might want context with regard to this clip, but this film is one that there's no context to be supplied other than the person that floated off keeps doing that throughout the entire film. And at the end of the film, you're still not sure if he's woken up, you're still asleep. It's very disjointed that way, so I can't say much more about that. But are there any questions about that?
So the point here is that rather than succumb to the action and thoughts that this person came to, if philosophy discussions had been applied, this need not happen, right?
Right, and
about the short story of it?
Yes, and I think not just on his part, right, but societally, mm-hmm. If these skills are more widespread, that he could feel like he could have an important or a meaningful conversation with somebody about these topics. He talked about voting and how he thought that was, you know, ridiculous. If people were more, philosophically aware and skilled, democracy wouldn't necessarily be so frustrating, perhaps. To
I have to answer this question.
Sure.
How does there's a comparison here with the gospel message, I just see the gospel message as love the Lord with all thy heart and all thy mind and soul, mm-hmm. love thy neighbor as thyself, I don't know if you equate that with philosophy, but it's a philosophy in that it's a way of life, a theology. Would that enter into your realm of teaching or thinking about this whole thing?
I wouldn't say that that's philosophy. I would say that that is certainly an outlook on life that would avoid a situation like this, I think, personally. And I personally think that's a valuable way to look at life. You know, I'm a Christian myself, so that's the way I look at life. But I think for a lot of people out there, you know, they're not Christians. They don't adhere to that. And philosophy then can be another means to at least, protect oneself against self-destructive tendencies and destructive tendencies in society as a whole. So I don't know if that helps, but I don't know if that answers your question.
I'm just curious about
yeah.
it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's confusing to me to think about philosophy,
mm-hmm.
your subject,
mm-hmm.
And it, in these movies, in The Matrix and in this,
mm-hmm.
and even in the Greek philosophy example that you gave, there's a pathway to, to evil,
mm-hmm.
To a life that is very unpleasant and disruptive.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if I would just walk out and I would say, philosophy, working with your head, could lead to that. Whereas I see the teachings of Christ, a reality-based teaching that doesn't lead to this a confusion
mm-hmm.
or discomfort and beyond.
Yes, I guess I would say, on the other hand, I think it's really important for people to think for themselves and come to, you know, whatever discoveries that they come to on their own. And if I might, because I always keep one eye on the time, if I might say one question, I think this might have been part of what you were getting at, maybe not, but one question that some people have about a film in particular is that maybe it's a fairly manipulative medium. It's very dominating. It influences people. Like, for example, I think a good example is Jaws, right? If you go and see the movie Jaws, and then you go swimming in the ocean, and what are you going to think about? Sharks.
Fear.
Yeah, right.
Fear.
Why? Because you just saw the film, not because of any sort of rational, you know, statistics or anything like that. And so clearly film has this way of dominating people and manipulating them, and I certainly agree with that. When I show The Matrix, I have a hesitance in doing that, or I hesitate to do that, because it definitely praises this sort of violent reaction to those who differ from you. I try and raise those issues in my class just to get them at least notice this, because of course the film is just glorifying, you know, machine guns and killing people in the name of higher truth. And of course I think that's really antithetical to the Christian message and to really what any reasonable person should believe. So I'm aware of that. And so I think there's a legitimate question, I'll get to your hand, but I think there's a legitimate question as to whether or not film is maybe too dominating and does it really have any kind of advantage in getting people to see truth of some kind. And I want to show a clip in just a minute from the same film here, Waking Life, that I think at least maybe gives some sense that maybe it's useful for that. But we'll get to that in just a second. You had your hand up.
Well, two things. I think that the dialogue there...
Yeah, yeah.
...was, it seems to me that the man who was feeling disenfranchised,
yeah,
as the man who took all those lives,
mm-hmm.
would grasp on those words,
right,
as something that rang true to him.
Yeah.
And I'm a music teacher,
mm-hmm.
and I really have a hard time with some of our patriotic songs, because
mm-hmm.
I again think they're manipulative,
mm-hmm.
and I choose them very carefully.
Right.
Because I don't want that to happen. I want those kids to think.
Right.
I don't want them to mindlessly march to the tune of the drums that we've gone and done violence in before.
Okay. Yeah.
You know?
Thanks for that example. And I know this scene of, I think, of all the scenes in the film, maybe one other scene in the film, I think does touch on maybe something that somebody like Jerem Wofner felt. Overwhelmingly, though, you know, the film is not like this. And so that's why I wonder why, you know, he would be so obsessed with this film, given that the overall message is not certainly this.
Maybe it was just that one clip.
It might have been, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if anybody knows the details there, but yeah, it might have been that one clip. You'll get a sense of the other part of this film, the next scene, because I think that the next scene I want to show you is about 5 minutes long. Helps to point out that I think film does have a particularly important relationship to reality. In the clip that you're about to see, a person whose name is Kaveh Zahedi, and he's a director and a writer, he talks to David Jewell, who's an actor and an artist. In the clip, Zahedi will refer to André Bazin, who's a noted French film critic. He's long passed away now, but noted French film critic and theorist, and he lived from 1918 to 1958, so he'll refer to André Bazin in this clip as well. And so let me just figure out the buttons here.
Too, though. I mean, why would you cry? Well, because, I don't know, it, for me, like, I just tend to cry.
Well,
let's do it. I can tell it's not my whole life.
Everything is layers, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's the holy moment, and then there's the awareness of trying to have the holy moment. It's in the same way that the film is the actual moment really happening, but then the character pretending to be in a different reality. And it's just all these layers. And I was in and out of the holy moment, looking at you. Can't be in a blink, but you're unique that way, Kaveh. That's one of the reasons I enjoy you. You can bring me into that.
Yeah, so my point in showing you that clip is just that the suggestion is made there by Kaveh that, and via André Bazin, that film captures reality and frames it, allows us to focus on things we might otherwise miss.
Yeah.
And I think that, I personally think that, that it does in many cases. I don't think that's incontrovertible. And, you know, we look at witness films these days like Avatar, completely sort of, in a sense, completely artificial from beginning to end. But nonetheless, I think for the most part, films can focus our attention on things we might otherwise miss and bring to people truths that would otherwise go unrecognized. And that's one of the reasons I think it's valuable to bring to a philosophical discussion. But do we have any questions or comments about that?
One of the things that, I mean, you can find this in Aquinas, you can find it in a lot of places. That the act of creation is something that is that's God, it's a God gift. It's a gift of the Creator,
right.
And that we're just sort of the vessels through which that act comes, and that's a lot of what I was getting from that whole catalog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bazin thinking that, you know, this the universe is this continual creation of God,
mm-hmm.
and that you're filming it, so you're in a sense filming God and getting that sort of recording that or focusing on different aspects of that. Right? Yeah, I think, right, you can hear echoes of that in lots of places. So. Other thoughts? Or?
Well, I probably am more on another field, but I'm thinking about the movie The Hunger Games.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking about how that has been such a kind of a reality for young people,
mm-hmm.
particularly in the teenage stage.
Right.
And, you know, frankly, it's disturbing to me
mm-hmm.
that kind of film reality would be what is being presented to teenagers. Now, other people may see the film and not have that kind of negative response to the reality that it's projecting.
Mm-hmm.
It's powerful, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree. And sort of one of my indirect, you might say, objectives in teaching a class like philosophy in the cinema is just to get students to realize that they can be manipulated by the images and sounds that they hear, and to be able to think through that and think for themselves and not just automatically agree with whatever the protagonists in the Matrix are doing or what have you. And that's difficult. I agree, in a film like The Matrix. Then you say a film like Waking Life, and it's just so confusing that it sort of, you know, throws them off, and they're not sure what to expect. Were you going to say something? Okay.
No, so it is confusing. The word confusing
yeah, absolutely.
Is right there
yeah.
with me.
Sure. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite quotes is by, I think his name is Bede Rundle, and it says that philosophy begins in wonder and ends in confusion, right? And I like that, but at any rate, yes.
Yeah, I was just thinking about how creating these kinds of conversations about film
mm-hmm.
really does give a lot of power to the student to be able to say, okay, how is this film manipulating? How is it not manipulating? What? How does this resonate with what we believe to be? I mean, in our culture, we're a Western culture, and we're based very much on basic philosophers, you know, what we believe. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it's really big questions that they're allowed to ask in this media, that in this medium that they know already.
Right.
Because of another language.
Yeah. And maybe if I can just pick up on that and then lead it to tomorrow's discussion. I think one of the problems for many, like, say, teenagers or younger people when they first encounter philosophy, not just younger people, but they read, you know, oh, I've read Nietzsche for the first time, and it's very powerful writing, and the ideas are very potent, and they sort of become acolytes, and they just, or recently the vice president, vice presidential candidate, Paul Ryan, right? At least earlier on, was just a big devotee of Ayn Rand. And I think that one of the things that film can do as well in a philosophical vein is get people to recognize the philosophical ideas at work, but also to laugh at yourself a little bit and to humble yourself a little bit. I think that's really important when you first encounter philosophy. And so tomorrow night, or tomorrow afternoon, I guess it is, we're going to watch some excerpts from the film I Heart Huckabees and Being John Malkovich, if you've seen those. But they are, I think, quite effective at getting people to laugh, but at the same time, think about some deep philosophical issues, and I think it's both important to be able to do both. So if you're interested, I encourage you to come out for that. But anything else?
I'm always, when I see something like that, with like the books that were huge with the kids, with vampires.
Yeah, the Twilight series.
Twilight series, mm-hmm. big with kids. Uh-huh. Now the Hunger Games. And I always try to say, what is it they're getting? What is it that draws them? What do they see that is way beyond, it's not even my reality, you know?
Right.
But, you know, in our generation, there were things like The Lord of the Flies.
I didn't, yeah.
And, well, but no, I mean, it's not just this generation.
Oh no, I don't even really know. I'm not judging this generation. I'm just saying, what are they seeing that I don't know about, that I need to look at,
mm-hmm.
and that I want to know what they're connecting with?
Right.
Because sometimes what I'm connecting with, they don't even, it's not reality to them at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Far more disturbing than The Hunger Games or any of these movies tonight or what you see on the nightly news.
Yeah.
We have a nation that spends more money on war making than all the other countries in the world put together. We've run into two disastrous wars, and the same sort of people that are making these movies that convince us that, you know, we need to start yet more wars, possibly in the very near future. I mean, to me, that's far more troubling than anything you might see in the movie.
Let me just say a couple things. On Wednesday, we're going to watch a couple clips from the movie The Battle of Algiers, which will touch on some of these issues directly relating to war, but also the good news, perhaps to end the night on, looking at the clock and Vespers coming up, is that the good news is that, of course, the young people don't watch the nightly news, so don't worry about that. So, at any rate...
They fight the wars,
though. They do.
They do. They march in.
Those wars are driven by the fears of people of our generation who are convinced that we're in greater danger now than ever been in the history of this country.
Right.
Yeah. We can maybe talk a little bit about that on Wednesday as to why that might be, and because we're gonna, the Battle of Algiers is a film that's sort of a pseudo-documentary, and I think it does some really interesting things with presenting what's supposed to be truth or not, and anyway, I don't want to say too much, but... just say thank you for coming out, and I'm here until Saturday at Home Village. And if you want a filmography or bibliography, I should have complete photocopies tomorrow. Or you can give me your email address, and I can email you when I get out of here and get to internet access again. But thanks again for coming out.
Thank you.